And welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 13th, 2002. Today's session is titled Prostitution, Trafficking, and Organized Crime, presented by Gail Gamuff McCoy. The tape number is GAG2002-02. Let's listen in.
You can roll the tape. Or yes, we're being taped here. I'm really sorry our handouts haven't come. They were supposed to be here yesterday in time for my first presentation. But what we'll do is they'll be available, I'm sure, on Thursday and Friday, and we'll designate a place in the village where you can get handouts. These are information packets that we brought on Genesis House, which has our Time magazine article in it and some other descriptions of things about prostitution and so on. So any of you that want that kind of information, it has our website on it. It has my direct confidential phone line on it and a number of things like that. That's in here. So I'm going to have to pass out some of the handouts, unfortunately. And if any of you have pen or paper, this one here is publications for further research on the Coalition of Trafficking Against Women. These are websites and human trafficking resources. These will be available later in the week if any of you want to write that down. This is an article called Slavery's New Face. And in this particular article, there is, for those of you who were there yesterday, you saw this. There is, there is a map of the United States and where the different entry points are for different countries of origin in our country for women and girls that are being trafficked, so you can... That's a great expression. Okay. This is the Munchkin one.
Yeah.
And you can get a real clear idea of how many countries are coming and being trafficked into the into this country, and just that this is slavery. So we'll pass that around. And then these are just a variety of articles, and most of this I'm going to address Thursday. Yesterday was the whole overview of international trafficking. Today I'm going to talk about what actually happens when they enter the United States and some legislation and things of that nature that have been done in this country to address trafficking. Thursdays will be particularly on the United States, how women become little girls, end up becoming to be prostitutes, what the social, political, and economic implications are of prostitution in America. We'll focus on American prostitutes. And as I said then, on Friday, we'll talk about a response to that and a way that you can go back to your communities and learn how to do something like Genesis House and how we set up that program. We have court programs, we have all kinds of different things, and where we get funding and how we operate and how we have a 70% success rate of rehabilitating women. So you can all take that back with you. And a lot of people here in the village have talked to me about starting a program in their own community and how we went about doing that. So that's what Thursday will be on, a particular focus on Genesis House. And I'm just going to pass these out. This is the position paper for the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women. And then these are some research studies on childhood abuse, girls entering sex trade. What we really hope to do and what we hope you can take back to your communities is education, that it's not about two consenting adults engaging in this act. It's really a lot about child abuse and pedophilia and then what happens, how you grow up. So you can just glance at these, and as I said, hopefully most of these will be available, but it'll give you some idea of what is going to be available for you.
So these are just individual copies that I should have.
Yeah, I'd like those to stay.
You can push it down. It'll go down. Just push.
Voila. Okay. Thank you. And I have caught the cough that seems to be so prevalent, so excuse me. I'm going to just kind of whiz through, because it's a little bit dry information initially, how people get into the United States and technically what happens. They basically enter the United States in three ways. One is the illegal use of legitimate travel documents. Secondly, we would have imposter passports. And third would be entry without any inspection at all.
You're so wonderful.
He even sponsors us here. Thank you. So the specifics of illegal entry are the easiest way is to overstay a visa. That is most prevalent with newly independent states, which are called NIS. That would be also Central Eastern Europe enters the country that way, and Asia. Another way would be with the B1, which is a B1 business visa. That's another way to enter the country. Also tourist visas, which are B2 visas. And that's the way that a lot of women get brought into the U.S. And as we know, the visa length varies from country to country. And because of the variations in the time and the length, visas can be recycled and used illegally. And when you can recycle them from a longer time, up to 10 years, that leaves a lot more room for abuse of visas. Other visas that are abused are F1, which are students, K1, which are fiancés, and entertainers, which are P1 and P3 visas. The traffickers coach the women on how to respond. In other words, if you're a student or an entertainer or a fiancé, what you might be. And the traffickers give you all the supporting documentation. So if you're a student, for example, all that supporting documentation would be falsified and presented to you. In other situations where you have these illegal traffickers posing with travel agencies, the people themselves turn over the documents to the travel agents, and then the recruiter takes over from there, the trafficker recruiter, and he takes care of all the documentation. That's one of the most dangerous things to happen to the women and girls, because that increases their control over them because they now have all their documents. So there's an abuse of the travel agency referral program. Many embassies use these travel agencies unknowingly, not knowing that they're illegal travel agencies, and they allow the travel agencies to do the visa applications because they just don't have the time, obviously, in some of these small and overburdened countries to really investigate that kind of thing. So many, many travel agencies are used as fronts for traffickers. They also have imposter passports for anyone who's ever gotten a passport stolen. Me. So the photos are substituted and changed on stolen documents, and they recycle valid passports that have been stolen. Another way is to use what we call a jockey person. This jockey person escorts a woman into the U.S. They're normally of Anglo origin, and they pretend to be a boyfriend, a cousin, a husband, or a fiancé. In some cases, as we know, they may actually marry the person on paper in order to get that woman into the United States. When this is done, usually ports of entry that are less familiar are used, and late-night flights are very common in this situation, and holidays where there's less officials there that can really pick up on the fact that maybe this is not a boyfriend, girlfriend, fiancé relationship. There's also another way, and that's one you've probably read a lot about. That's simply entry without any inspection whatsoever. In Latin America, the people who do this are called coyotes. They transport aliens on foot, and that's why they're called coyotes. And they normally bring them on foot over the borders, over the vast borders of the United States. The other way, and we've all, I'm sure, read and heard tragic, horrible stories about this, is through U-Hauls, vans, and buses. And I'm sure all of you have read horrifying stories about vans or railroad, things that are abandoned, and they find all the people dead of heat stroke and suffocation inside of there, and the driver just simply runs away when he becomes threatened of some kind of arrest. That usually costs around $700 to $2,000 per person to be taken in this way with a coyote transport. And normally what will happen, in some cases they stop, and it's a huge problem in Mexico right now, they stop partway in Mexico and they begin to demand more money from the family at home to actually get the person across the border, and they keep exploiting. And there's now big camps in Mexico where these people who are trying to get into the United States have been just stopped somehow and never make it, and they continue to exploit them for more money, and usually it's their families back home. So another big point of entry is Canada to the U.S. as well, that organized crime and international traffickers are using. I'll give you an extreme example. Recently, a 22-year-old Chinese girl was actually kidnapped, and she was put on a Taiwanese boat, and she was smuggled in. She was immediately forced to work as a prostitute. There she was confined, raped, and tortured, and this is not uncommon. She was finally able to break away and tell her story, but these are many, many creative ways of bringing people in, and that's just another one. Another way is to book an international flight that transits through the U.S., that the U.S. is not the destination, but we stop in the U.S. Then the trafficker is there to meet the person. The person absconds from the airport without ever meeting the connecting flight. That is a common. You might ask, in this country, what are the major ports of entry? They are Los Angeles, New York City, Miami, Chicago's O'Hare, and San Francisco. The newest and largest growing ports of entry in the United States are Atlanta, Cleveland, Houston, Orlando, Florida, and Washington, D.C. So I'm sure all of you here must live near one of those places so you can see how huge this problem has become, that these are just basic, continuous entry points, and they work like business. They work very smoothly. Once the woman's here, they're moved around the country to provide what we call fresh faces for the customers, so they continuously have new women and new experiences, new sexual experiences. This is, number one, to disorient the victim so that she never knows, you know, obviously this person half, you know, some of them are kidnapped, they're going through this horrific experience, so it disorients her. She doesn't know exactly where she is, she doesn't speak the language, she doesn't connect with anybody. She does not then develop a relationship with what might be a sympathetic client, someone who might care and would help her. That won't happen because they keep moving her. Mexican women and girls are on a very defined circuit. They are rotated every 15 days in this country, and there are 11 cities that they're rotated through, just like clockwork. That's how smoothly it works. They also engage, if they find them not to be prostitution material, for example, they use them for peddling or begging. This is normally where disabled individuals are used, to peddle or to beg. And it's the same system. They're also rotated, just in case someone, again, would be sympathetic or law enforcement would connect with someone. So the peddlers and the beggars are also rotated, and again, to disorient them. When we think about commercial sexual exploitation, in terms of gender, you have to realize that this bolsters gender inequality, the whole notion of prostitution and sexual exploitation. And it spills over into all areas of our society. And I think you, for anybody who's heard some modern music or seen different films and all that kind of thing, it increases sexual violence against women. And again, and I said this in the first workshop, this is why Genesis House stands firmly against legalization, but we do support decriminalization and taking the funds that are used to incarcerate women and using those funds to rehabilitate. It also even increases harassment of women in the workplace. And it increases violence against women by their partners. These are all scientific studies that have been done about sexual exploitation. The global sex industry merchandises women for a variety of reasons, and girls, and I want to emphasize that, and we've found them as young as 7 in the sex industry in this country, for prostitution, the sex trafficking, sex tourism, sex hotels. Those are common, and as I said yesterday, they can be found on the internet quite easily, so if you're touring the country, you can find where the sex hotels are, where the brothels are. And they'll even display the picture and what the girl does sexually, so whatever your preference is. Mail order, bride-to-be trade, they're often thinking they're going to be a bride, and they end up being a prostitute. And pornography, they're all interconnected. Sexual exploitation practices are all connected, and they're all connected with pedophilia and violence against children. And the main thing I want you to take away from that is that rape, sexual assault, domestic violence, and prostitution are connected. You know, prostitution isn't over here. It's part of this continuum. So when you break into one, you try to impact the connectedness of all those things. It takes multiple forms. So when these girls and women are prostituted, they're always pressured into pornography. As in this country, we know that runaways, you know, a lot of and a lot of the snuff films which existed with pornography with the individual being killed at the end were runaway children that were a lot of times taken over the border and they're killed at the end of the film. That's what a snuff film is. So people are pressured into pornography and sexual entertainment. The sexual entertainment of strip clubs, topless bars, precedes and accompanies prostitution. Those go hand in hand. Those are not separate kinds of things either. They're then subjected to abuse and very violent practices. And these, again, are women and children. Sex that is painful, that is disgusting, that is humiliating, and that is dangerous and rape-like. It is not Pretty Woman. They have unwanted bodily invasions, and I'll leave that to your imagination. And they have abuse and dehumanizing sexual practices that non-prostituted women would refuse to do. They often are forced to take drugs and alcohol, or that ends up being a result of the lifestyle. And then they begin to have disassociated mental states, which we'll talk a little bit more about tomorrow, the actual results and what happens, which we call dissociative disorder, which is basically that splitting because you can't endure it. You can't endure what's going on, so you split. So the consequences are create injury to physical and mental health. It could severely compromise someone's well-being. More than 80% of these women contract a sexually transmitted disease. They have chronic pelvic pain, pelvic inflammatory disease, unwanted pregnancies. Remember, there's a lot of customers that refuse to wear condoms, insist on not wearing condoms. So a lot of unwanted pregnancies, miscarriages. And then after all that happens, their infertility rates go up. They have an increased rate of reproductive cancers. They have to acquiesce, you must understand, to the customer's demands. If they don't do that, the price of resistance is often violence, severe violence against them, either by the trafficker, the pimp, or the customer themselves. They're not in a position at all to demand safe sex, you can imagine. They have no power at all in this situation. The result of exploitation is increasingly a death sentence. And in Chicago, we've had serial killers. You just had one discovered in Seattle. Same thing, I think it was the Green River killer, am I correct? Okay, so you see that. And in a study called Prostitution in Five Countries that was done in 1998, in Kenya, the HIV rate for women in prostitution was 52%. It was 50% in Cambodia. It was 34% in northern Thailand, 50% in Bombay, India, and 50 to 70% in Burma. So you see this is a growing industry. It's getting worse. It's reached epidemic proportions. In Italy, for example, the number of prostitution arrest crime was 2% in 1988. It was 16% in 1998, and that's worse now. And yesterday I talked about Albania. A lot of Albanian girls that are just merely kidnapped on the streets are being sent to Italy for prostitution. The violence is extreme. It is extreme violence. If this was happening to anybody else, people would be outraged by this. And you really should be. It is a human rights issue. They are beaten, they're raped, they're tortured, and often killed. And a recent Canadian study on sex said it also, or on sexual exploitation, said that the mortality rate increases for a prostitute by 40 times. 40 times. It's an outrage. The psychological harm, suicidal feelings, clinical depression, dissociative disorders, which I'll address, and post-traumatic stress disorder, which there have been studies done that women in prostitution and sexual exploitation have a higher rate of post-traumatic stress syndrome than Vietnam vets because of the horrific things. It's like a prisoner of war. It is exactly like that. From a study, the study, again, prostitution in five countries, in South Africa, Thailand, Turkey, the U.S., and Zambia, this is the mental health and different factors, social, socioeconomic factors. 67% suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome. 58% experienced sexual abuse frequently, more than four times in the recent month. 72% are homeless, and 92%, which is something I'll zero in on Friday, 92% wanted to leave. So if you remember anything else, it's not this, this is my free will, my free choice, and I really enjoy it. 92% want out any way they can get out. 72% wanted refuge. Just get me out of here. Just find anywhere, someplace to help me. 70%, after they got out and found refuge, wanted job training so they could support themselves and do something else. Now, there are actually people that argue pro-sex trade. And what do they say? That it's not a human, this is organized crime, mind you, that it's not a human rights concern because they entered consensually and voluntarily. And tomorrow we'll go more on what happens, why you enter. But the reality is that powerful social conditions mediate this process. This is what actually happens. A lot of women engage in when you're trafficked, in survival sex. They have children. If any of you saw the Afghanistan lecture yesterday, which was really excellent, you saw women. One of them had 16 children. Her husband had been killed. So for some women, it really ends up on survival sex to feed their children. They have absolutely no skills. And that supports an impoverished family. Some of them have to survive economically after they escape a terribly abusive situation, and they have no skills, and they don't know what to do with themselves. Many, as I said, are abused children, that there's a predisposition then to become victimized and to continue that kind of behavior into adulthood because it's been taught to them. There's an article, I don't have it with me today, about a girl in Africa whose grandfather, I think, first sodomized her at the age of four, I believe. And she goes into her story of continuous abuse from her grandfather and how she eventually ended up in prostitution because of that. They enter conditions normally as children. The average age of entry in the U.S. is 14 to 18. And studies do show that two-thirds of women in prostitution are sexually abused as children. So when you become this kind of traumatized and broken person, there's really, and no one's out there to help you because, again, there's this ignorance, I think, that's perpetuated by those people who prey on prostitutes and make money off of prostitutes, that we don't need the help to help them because it's a voluntary choice. And that's what needs to be turned around. And remember who's exploited: female, young, and poor. That's who gets exploited. Members of groups with histories of slavery and discrimination. So it continues. The abuse and the human rights violation continue. Children traumatized from sexual abuse. Women who have been trafficked or emigrated from poor countries. Women who are addicted to drugs and alcohol and therefore really aren't making coherent decisions, or women who are mentally ill. That's frequent. We have seen at Genesis House psychotic women that are out on the street and they don't even really know exactly what they're doing out there. And also, there are cultures that expect their girls to sacrifice themselves. That's prevalent in some cultures where they condone or they sell their daughters and in the expectation that money will be brought back home for them. And the daughter, certain daughters are expected to do that for the well-being of the family and the community. So the global sex industry preys on racial discrimination, socioeconomic inequality, and it profits from it. It reinforces it, and it exploits the groups at the bottom of the gender, race, socioeconomic-based hierarchies. So it turns them into, for the sexual and entertainment, basically, of the more powerful members of society. And we see that in our country. I mean, this is one of the issues. The customers are police, judges, lawyers, politicians, etc. These are your customers. So, you know, try and turn that around. And what basically turns it around a little bit is some fear. You know, you have to put the fear factor into them to get the funding to start these programs. So it makes inequality immensely profitable. It's a billion, multi-billion dollar industry. So a little bit about what is being done. A lot more was being done in the Clinton administration. As you know, since September 11th, the INS is really cracking down. But Clinton and Madeleine Albright really kind of wanted an international response to this, and they addressed the problem with Congress. And they wanted to somehow get other countries to participate. And those of you who were here yesterday know that one of the things organized crime does is pay off all the officials in other countries. So that's another way they're making money, not only selling the people, but paying off officials. So everybody's pocketing money. So this is a huge problem. So President Clinton started an international crime control strategy. And it was aimed at prevention, protective support for victims, and to prosecute the traffickers. So part of that was a T visa, which was a humanitarian, non-immigrant status visa classification. So the people would receive it's a trafficking visa, that's why it's called T, and they would receive temporary resident status. They would get support at home when they were sent back to their home. They would receive assistance, and the traffickers would be prosecuted. So there was prosecution and enforcement and pressing for laws and increase the penalties. Also, when they have financial penalties, because remember this is extremely lucrative, that money could be used for restitution, to set up these funds to help people transition back into their communities with jobs, homes, support, food, etc. And they were trying to get new laws on the books about involuntary servitude, because there's a lot of debate about who is trafficked, who is smuggled, what does that mean, and we're really caught up in a lot of gray areas legally right now. So the departments and the states of justice began a lot of dialogue about identifying and cracking down on trafficking. Then an effort began with U.S. embassies and consulates worldwide to start to get connected and to unite to stop this problem. So all of that started happening with dialogue, and in the year 2000, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act was passed in the United States. And I'm not going to read all the provisions. You can find it on the internet. It's a huge, huge act. And again, that's the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which did pass. But it was to direct the Secretary of State of the United States to include now the information on trafficking when they make the annual reports of the countries, as you're well informed about with human rights violations and so on. That became now a category that we will follow countries doing that. It established an interagency task force to work on trafficking. It called for measures to enhance, and this is key, economic opportunity for the victims of trafficking in these countries, to increase public awareness, which is what we try and do at Genesis House, and we hope all you will do. There's most everywhere now in different cities and towns has groups and a meeting on trafficking. Seattle's probably is a big port of entry, too, because of where it is. And to establish programs in other countries with a victims fund, to provide protection for victims, to recognize this as abuse and try and encourage and protect them so they will come forward and prosecute the criminals and really protect them while they're in federal custody instead of, you know, instant deportation. And again, to seize the funds, to begin to seize the funds of the traffickers and use that for all of these programs in the country. And to amend the U.S. code, which we have now, to double the penalties. This was all presented. Right now, and I'm not sure, again, a lot of things changed with September 11th, there's $30 million pending from the State Department to begin some of these programs in the United States where people could begin to organize and not-for-profit organizations could do that. So in December of 2000, due to this pressure by the United States, 81 members of the UN did sign protocol of this nature. And the only countries that did not sign were China, the Ukraine, the Czech Republic. But it still has to be ratified by 40 nations, so it's pending. What are the current debates? Why hasn't more been done? Well, the efforts haven't filtered down to local law enforcement. And again, I refer to September 11th and about the disconnection of all the agencies, which we saw, and the response to that. And it's the same thing with trafficking, with that disconnection. They're stalling due to, there's a big divergence of opinion on how big of a problem is it. And again, what you see in prostitution in our country, a lot of people like to blame the victim and say, oh, they want it. That's why they know they're going to do that, you know, and that's why they're coming and so on. Also, again, the definition of trafficking. Law enforcement is really hampered by these policies and the lack of coordination. It's really difficult. The FBI is still actually building its computer system right now. And I can tell you, and I told people yesterday in Chicago, there are only two FBI agents working on this for the entire city of Chicago, which is, you know, it's ridiculous to even think that they can make a dent. And the INS still believes in forced deportation, and it's worse now. I just came back from Brazil, and they were all talking there about how difficult it is now to get a visa. So it's become actually worse than pre-September 11th. So, again, and who do you decide gets a T visa? Who's actually trafficked? Who's smuggled? You know, that is just so gray also. And is the U.S. adequately organized to fight trafficking? No. And it's the best organized country. So if we're not even organized, what are we going to do? So I'm going to talk a little bit to close today with what you can do and then entertain some questions. You have to, and I guess have, I shouldn't use that word, but recognize that everybody has the fundamental right to be free from sexual exploitation. And we're talking internationally today, but we'll also really talk about that in the United States of America, because we're no better than these other countries. Repudiate all attempts to legitimize prostitution as work. And that's why Genesis House will not use the word sex workers, by the way. Even though it's a very common term, we do not recognize it as work. We recognize it as exploitation and victimization. Strengthen, there's two international rights instruments now that you may or may not be aware of. In 1949, there was a convention on trafficked persons. So this has been going on a long, long time. It's getting worse and worse. And it was post-World War II where this convention took place with all the trafficking. And this talked about the eliminations of all form of discrimination and trafficking and included, for one of the first times, the discrimination against women. And that convention established this as a vitally important human rights issue, and it's a potential wedge against pimps and traffickers. Now, unfortunately, it wasn't ratified. It was only ratified, again, by a few countries, and those who don't engage in these are to an extent. Most countries do, but in these practices. We must revolutionize the approach of the criminal justice system in this country and other countries, and that's Thursday. We'll talk about criminal justice in the United States, and insist on justice wherever you can and speak out about it. These are really marginalized people in the world. These are people that traditionally people have just not cared about because of a lack of understanding and education of what the issues are around trafficking and prostitution. Women and children must be protected. They are not. They're not in this country. When women's rights came around in the 60s, they left prostitution and trafficking behind. It was not seen as an important issue to the women's rights movement. And there's a lot of history about that. Domestic violence was seen as important, and abuse against children was seen as important, but not prostitution, because it was still looked upon as a voluntary choice. We must press for the successful prosecution of pimps and traffickers. They need to be prosecuted. They need to be held accountable for what they're doing to other people. And if you know people in law enforcement and you know judges, you know anybody who deals with this, you need to really push for that and not make it okay to let them go. There have to be witness protection programs for people that are trafficked, just like those who are relocated in this country that will talk against other forms of organized crime. Why don't we have those programs for people that are trafficked so that they can have new identities and witness protection and all that kind of thing? We need to grant asylum to some people who really can't go back. They need to be granted asylum in this country and given the tools to have another life, because there are a lot of people that really can't go back to where they came from after this experience. We need to have prevention campaigns and educate the public, and especially our children, about these kinds of things. Children are really ignorant today about this. It's because of what popular culture promotes about pimps and hoes and music, and, you know, it makes it all really okay. And almost glorifies it. One of my friend's eighth grade son wears a cologne called Pimp, you know, and he's really proud of that. And I was trying to talk to him a little bit about it and what that means. And women, young women, are going along with all this. You know, the women's movement is seen as pretty passé, and people not getting that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you could not be a surgeon. You know, you couldn't be a lawyer. You know, women's rights is not, you know, the hatred of men. It's really not. It's about discrimination. And prostitution is still a women's rights issue, that women traditionally have turned against prostitutes. They really have. And to kind of realize that's your sister, you know, who's being exploited there, and bring that into the women's issues forum and realize it's connected. And there's a lot more work to be done in this area. And again, we do not, and I can't say this enough, protect our kids. There may be laws on the books, but they're not being protected. And the recent attention to pedophilia shows, and it's rampant in this country. It's rampant. And also, again, as I said yesterday, the murders of children and rapes of children that have been so prominent in the news, and the horrifying things that are happening. A lot of times you can link that all back to pornography, literature these men are reading. Again, there's snuff pornography out there for anybody who wants it. That's where someone gets the idea that they're going to take this, was she six or seven in California, and rape her and kill her and strangle her. It's all linked up, and there's plenty of that to see and reinforce those deviant kinds of thoughts and behaviors. And because of our sexual attitudes in this country and our lack of education, none of that's really dealt with too well. And people are just kind of on their own seeking out pornography and magazines and all these kinds of things with very little intervention until there's a horrible crisis like that. So, and you've got to demand, I mean, really demand that the governments and the private sector demand to develop and expand this programming for these survivors. After all, they're victims. They're not psychopaths and sociopaths. They want out. They want rehabilitation. They want help. Why don't we offer it? Why don't we give that help? What is going on? You know, we rehabilitate. And I will tell you this, and I'm not trying to be discriminatory here, but I'll tell you, if 92% of men committing some crime said, give me a program and I'll stop doing this tomorrow, bingo. Believe me, the money would be there. It would be there. Because it's 92% of the women saying, I want out of here. Oh, well. And because the customers are actually the people that pass the laws and give the money, you know, not all, of course, but we do know. It's in the news all the time, you know, Senator so-and-so, Governor so-and-so, you know, caught dancing at the strip club, you know, drunk out of his mind with a prostitute. So that's another reason. You know, there's kind of a ambivalent feeling about rehabilitating them. But if it were male offenders, 92%, and we're spending all this money on incarceration and all this money, the programs would be there. Believe me, they would be. So that's another thing to really kind of get militant about that. It also, we need the same programs as we developed 20, 25 years ago for domestic violence. We need to be smart about this and work with our women's organizations, our mental health organizations, and really enable people and provide refuge. People need a place to go. That's what Genesis House is marginally involved in with an international trafficking in Chicago. Where are you going to go? There has to be a safe haven. They need psychiatric counseling, free and confidential medical care, which I'll get into a little bit tomorrow about the kind of discrimination that encounters someone that actually goes and asks for medical help when they're involved in prostitution and how they're treated, and legal aid. So, again, you need to counteract the sex industry defenders, and again, with links who are profiting from slavery of other people, that have persuaded many in thinking that global sex trade cannot be eliminated, that it can only be regulated and organized. To institutionalize slavery is really fundamentally wrong, and I think you all know that. We need to insist that the exploitation of new generations and populations of women and children cannot be accepted. And again, there are men and boys that are trafficked and used in prostitution, and that is not my focus, but I just want to reemphasize that there are many men and boys, especially boys, that end up in prostitution. That sexual exploitation is no more inevitable than race-based slavery. Many people believed a long time ago that that was inevitable because of your race. It is the same kind of ignorance to think that. And we can stop it with political will. I mean, there are more and more. We see, as places like Genesis House pressure our legislators and our congressmen, pressure Washington. The Congressional Black Caucus, for example, is very vocal and active about this subject in the government, and a lot of our funding comes from the Congressional Black Caucus initiatives, and we're very thankful for their activism in the government. So it's time to really, we hear the term zero tolerance. This is a zero tolerance issue. It really is. If you can campaign and get involved, it has to be just like domestic violence, the same kind of posters and messages and everything you see. Because there's still an okayness about it in society, about prostitution. There's still a mentality that's pervasive that needs to be turned around. And it is a human rights issue to be realized in this country. So with that, I conclude. And I ask if there's any questions or discussion about this topic today.
Would you say that promoting prostitution is not being aggressively pursued by law enforcement, prosecutors, and whatnot as a reflection of sort of this tolerance, this sort of a conscious tolerance or separating it from exploitation of women? Because, of course, domestic violence is being very aggressively pursued, it would seem.
Yes, I do. I think that we've traditionally accepted it in some places as a rite of passage. For men, you know, the bachelor party, we have women in our program that's where they got their start in prostitution. You know, they came and they performed at bachelor parties and so on and so forth, and then eventually someone offers them money to sleep with them. So it's all these seemingly innocent portals of entry that end up in this abusive situation, and I've gone on record. I do lecture quite a bit. I've been on a lot of television, radio stations. I don't believe it's a healthy choice for one. Now, you know, they'll get Coyote, which is the group to legalize, will get on TV and say, you know, well, so-and-so is a medical student, and she worked her way through college, you know, as a prostitute. And I really always counted with, well, what healthy person does that? I mean, what emotionally healthy person decides, well, you know, I think I'll sleep with, you know, 200 people this year to get through medical school. It's really not a healthy choice. And that's what I focus on. You know, why didn't you get a scholarship and work just as hard and just as many hours, you know? But there's a lot of debate about legalizing that it is a healthy choice. But we see a lot of women in Las Vegas, in Nevada, outside of Las Vegas, in the counties where it's legal, saying that they didn't receive a lot of the money, that they were forced to buy their toiletries and different things like that through the individuals that were controlling the prostitution. So, you know, that one who makes all this money and goes out and writes her book about it is 1% of the population. You know, maybe she's that 8% of the 92%, but that's so rare. And I really think if you dug deeply into that person's psyche, you would find issues. You know, because it's really, you'd find issues from childhood.
the sex trade's influence on popular music as far as how the music and the videos are desensitizing the young people to oral sex.
Well, I think Bill Clinton desensitized everybody. I want to be president when I grow up, you know? Something to aspire to. I think they're all shocked that they're getting oral sexually transmitted diseases. That's the other issue I spoke to a little about. We had this idea, this vision of starting a school program where you really learn to be sexually healthy and going, and you know, it was just from day one, forget it. You must be, that's not going to happen. But when you look at high school students taking ecstasy and having orgies and participating in oral sex in the hallway behind the gym, and how many people can you give oral sex to within a day? And parents are so, you know, shocked and horrified. And I mean, this is a national phenomena, and it is encouraged and supported by the popular culture, the music videos, you know, films, exploitation films. And I just don't, there seems to be some real big disconnection between the government and the schools and everybody getting it, and all the media continuously writing stories about what's going on with orgies and ecstasy and oral sex and oral, you know, orally transmitted diseases. You know, it's just bizarre to me that there's just such this huge divide of people. And I think it's traditionally, when things are really unpleasant for people to look at, you know, we know this about racism and all different kinds of other things, and it's just much easier to stick your head in the sand. I worked a long time in healthcare administration, and just kind of a little, we had to all get trained about satanic ritualistic abuse against children and how they look when they present in the emergency room and what the symptoms are, because it's traditionally seen as something that's so fantastic that the child must be lying and it never happened to them, but yet it does. And so it was rarely reported or overlooked because that kind of ritualistic abuse is usually from families and communities of, you know, it's passed down from generation that you may think or actually believe that you're a witch or a warlock or whatever it is you think you are, and you're abusing these children, killing animals in front of them. There's a lot of stuff about feces involved and sexuality. It's different. It presents a little differently from other forms of child abuse. But the reason it's never, ever, ever almost identified in court is because people just don't believe it. They don't want to believe it. It's too ugly and dark and subversive and nasty and those waters swirling around. So people don't like to look at that stuff. And I think it's the same that a parent doesn't want to think that their daughter's giving someone oral sex behind the locker at lunchtime. Or maybe she's got the record that day. Maybe she's done it 5 times that day, which is happening in high schools. So
blowjobs.
So oral sex of girls on boys.
Yeah, it's very prevalent.
But would you say that oral sex among consenting adults are loving? I mean, are you against oral sex?
Oh, no. She's talking about what's going on in high schools, and we're talking about the lack of sex education and healthy sexual attitudes.
Well, I'm wondering if the sex trade is influencing the music business.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Listen to the lyrics.
There are so many parents. I mean, I'm a teenager, and there's so many parents that are like, what are you talking about? Our kids, you know. My sister-in-law said, do you think our girls are still virgins? I said, you know, their courses, and oral sex is a thing for teenagers.
But also, I mean, the statistics show you how much earlier people are having sex. I mean, it's just a statistical fact. Mm-hmm. You know, and to continue to ignore it is ridiculous. But, you know, it is a fact. It is proven. You know, this is known. And also just the biological changes in girls in our country, menstruation, all that kind of thing, due to the chemicals and hormones in our foods, getting breasts sooner, all that stuff is also being documented that's going on. So there's lots of changes. And we have the highest, you know, of the Western countries of, you know, birth rates for girls, for adolescents and girls under the age of 18. We ignore that. We won't even give condoms in high school, you know. It's bizarre, you know, that a country that's this intelligent and educated is so Victorian about sexuality and in the face of all kinds of other kinds of evidence just refuses to really deal. You know, if you don't learn it at home, you're going to get that classic high school lecture with the stuff, you know, this is the vagina, you know, this is, and that's all you're really going to get.
So healthy sexuality, I think a lot of people we know that abuse children are very unhealthy, sick people. And then that kind of abuse starts, and then the child becomes acting out sexually. It's just this bad, bad, keeps on rolling.
I have to say, being part of the public school system, we have incredibly wonderful programs that talk to students.
Where are you?
In Oregon.
Oh, good.
Where students get the information, whether they receive it or not, the information is there, or how they receive it. The information is there in terms of healthy relationships, living safely. It's incredible to hear what the students bring in those environments.
That's great.
Shocking to someone in my generation, and I have to listen more to what's involved in their lives because it's so foreign to my life.
Yeah.
And the other issue is the healthy kids I'm seeing are the ones whose parents are spending full time being parents.
Mm-hmm.
And they're spending so much time being parents that they don't choose to do other things with their lives, like for their own personal entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Their entertainment is their children, their family. Mm-hmm. And I see enough of that that I have some hope.
Yeah.
And well, I hear what you're saying too.
No, and your school's unusual. But, you know, because I know there's HIV and all these other kinds of educational programs, but you're right. I think kids, you know, I mean, today, and I think people always say that, but to what I was exposed to and what teens are exposed to today, it's just absolutely, they're bombarded with things that we weren't. I mean, and I think with mass media, cable television, you know, all of that, I mean, it's so different. And parents do have to really be vigilant, and I think it's a pretty much different world.
I was the parent mom and for one of my kids when they were in ninth grade, and we put on a day-long thing on human sexuality for the ninth graders. And all the parents were asked to come, and all the kids were there, and we had really good educators. At the end of it, we had a big discussion in the lunchroom, and the kids were reporting back out of groups. We had them in groups, not with their own parents, you know, for discussion around different issues and stuff. One group stood up and said, "We know so much about sex. We know all about how sex can kill you. We know all about the physical stuff of sex. We know all about AIDS. We know this, we know that." A different group had talked tearfully about the girls feeling pressured to have sex with the boys and whether they had a right to say no, and then the boys feeling pressured to be macho, and, you know, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful day. But ultimately, this one group said, kind of pathetically to the grown-ups, they said, "We want to know why you'd ever have sex. What's good about sex? What's it for? Why would you... It can ruin us emotionally. We know that. We can be destroyed by it." And it was this kind of pathetic longing for hearing about human mutuality and cherishing and love and marriage. And, you know, so, and the parents were all kind of dumbfounded. You know, they didn't quite know what to say in return. But we rose to the occasion. But I think it's really important to talk about sex in positive ways with kids, too.
That's what I'm talking about when I say that kind of, that's exactly it. You know, love and respect, and not just HIV kills you, you know. Because most programs in Chicago are more about that, HIV, sexually, how do you actually perform the sex act, and not about respect. And so that's, and if you have a movement like that where you are, that's wonderful, but it's usually focused more on exactly, and I'm sure, and that's what I think needs to change. And I think women and girls need to get on top of it too. I know when we do have high school girls come in, they're just saying what they will do and how they will, when they go back to their high schools, how the music and the songs and the word ho and the word pimp and all that, It takes on a new significance. It's not okay anymore. And for many of them, until they got that kind of education, it was okay. It was accepted in the hall. You know, it was an accepted kind of way to talk about women. So, and that's always gratifying to see girls go back and say, "I'm not going to let, if I hear someone say that, I'm going to talk to him about it." And I think more of that kind of thing than the public health sort of approach, which is prevalent. You know, we have a lot of public health initiatives out there, but
just becoming healthy people and stopping unhealthy things. And, you know, now they're working more on kids, on saying no. And that little girl again in California, that so tragic, when he grabbed her, she was screaming. She was fighting. She fought all the way and was yelling, you know, tell my grandmother. It's so tragic because she had been taught, you know, run away, resist. And she didn't have the opportunity, unfortunately, to do that. But I think there's a Miss America who's older now, and she was abused by her father. She was from Denver, I believe, and he was a wealthy industrialist. And one of the messages she gives when she is telling, you know, and if your mother doesn't listen because it happens to be your stepfather, then tell the teacher. And if the teacher doesn't listen, you know, tell some another teacher. And really, because I do think that's true, the more kids tell and tell early and expose people early and really supported and encouraged to do that. And a lot of times we do know that the other parent or the parent involved knows what's going on. This girl in Africa said that her mother had taken her for an operation when she was 5 years old, you know, and then denied that she was having her repaired. And so must have known, the mother must have known all along that this grandfather was doing this, because she actually took her for medical intervention and would not tell her own father to stop doing this to her daughter. So oftentimes, you know, it's not telling your mother, because your mother's not going to protect you. She's somehow afraid, or the culture doesn't, you know, help. But it is also the message of telling. Tell on people. Tell until somebody helps you. And a lot of times if a child's rebuffed the first time, they never tell again and go on to endure that. This girl endured this until he actually died. He did it until he died. And she was 12 years old when he died.
Why do you think that when the child tells the mother is hard, it's difficult for the mother to believe it or support it?
A lot of times she's financially dependent in some way on the perpetrator, or it's cultural that she can't confront the male doing this. I mean, there's a variety of reasons, but she actually sells out her child for her own benefit in a lot of different reasons. And or because, again, she's not empowered enough to confront the person about it. But there's actually cases in America I read about, a recent one where the girl came forward and the mother told her to leave the house. You get out of the house. You know, he stays here, you're out. And she was like 16 years old. She threw out of the house. So they, you know, they make her the victim. The man will often say, she seduced me, she enticed me, you know, she wanted me. And the woman prefers to believe that than the victim and what she says. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons, but denial, you know, not wanting to disrupt your life. You know, you don't want the routine. I had, in private practice, this man had actually drilled a hole in the garage and was looking through, you know, watching his stepdaughter, and then he began to abuse her. And even with the evidence of the hole in the garage, you know, this mother was in denial. You know, why would a hole be drilled into her bedroom through the garage? Oh, I don't know, maybe he was going to hang a hook there. I mean, it was just, you know, because she doesn't want to give up that man in her life. And also the men, you know, or the perpetrators, it's not always men. Some women abuse children as well. But, you know, a lot of times there's that kind of lack of guilt and lack of empathy. We find this in people that perpetrate these kinds of crimes. And that's kind of a denominator, a lack of guilt, lack of empathy. So they walk around really. And this study, and I will have it available, she noted that he never seemed to feel guilty or have any empathy for what he was doing to her or her pain. And that's a common denominator with people that abuse children. Lately, there's been studies saying that there's not a direct link if you're an abused child to going on and abusing other children. That people who have not been abused also abuse, but they have that sociopathic tendency.
Yeah, I think this is it's really important to recognize how pervasive this is. I mean, I've even experienced this right up here in this community before. Last week, I had a son who came to me and said that one of his, you know, the boys he was playing with was being pursued by some very young girls who were bragging about all their conquests. And, you know, it was a struggle. My son was kind of coaching and supporting this other boy. And often boys don't really get the support.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly, And it's all socioeconomic levels. It's professional families that knows no boundaries racially, culturally, socioeconomically. We had one little boy, and when he was picked up for shoplifting, he was 6, I think. The first thing he did is offer the officers oral sex to get out of it, and his mother was using him, you know, in prostitution, and the police officers were shocked, you know. But if you ever get, and Andrea Dworkin is a fairly radical feminist, but her research on discrimination, prostitution, exploitation is excellent. She has a film of one of the Washington area organizations like Genesis House, and she also has books. But in this film, they show a woman with dissociative disorder. In this film, she did. And it's Dworkin. And this woman was used in pornography and prostitution as a young girl. She becomes, gets some pornography, becomes a prostitute. And she's sort of like this, you know. She clearly has post-traumatic stress syndrome, and she's talking about her baby and how, you know, customers came in and they pick up her baby and enter the baby, do all kinds of things to the baby. And then at one point she goes, well, you know, and she's sort of talking like this. At one point, somebody killed my baby. And she says, well, I guess that's wrong, isn't it? She says, no. She's sort of kind of sure, but she's not really sure. And it just, it's really chilling to watch this video and see some of these testimonials, because she is just like somebody who's brainwashed and a prisoner of war. And that's the other thing. If somebody comes into the house, and you see this with bad foster care situations, and I want to say not all foster care, you know, there's a lot of great foster care situations where somebody comes in to be with the mother and ends up with the child as well. Very common. And a lot of, in other countries, foreign countries, where girls are sold, you know, even to husbands, to 60, you know, they'll sell a 12-year-old to a 60-year-old husband. A lot of, you know, gynecology, a lot of problems develop with their organs, and so on and so forth, and there's not the surgery available to help them. Some of these girls die from this kind of sexual abuse, and that's actually being sold for a dowry in their own country. And $34 million that Bush just vetoed for family planning is just another horrific thing. That happened because the UN had voted that none of this money goes ever for abortion, ever. It's all for family planning, like the lady yesterday who had 16 children by the time she was 30. And how many were dead?
10
were dead. So this $34 million was just vetoed by Bush for family planning, which is a drop in the bucket, you know, just so girls that are 12 and 13 and 14 aren't having babies and don't have 6 babies by the time they're 20. And their health impaired. It's all kinds of other issues. So I didn't even know that. I can't imagine a veto family planning money. So it was over before anybody could protest about it.
What was the explanation for the veto?
He used a lame explanation, which was that it goes for abortions, but it's not true. But, you know, by the time it was vetoed, it was, I actually presented at the University of Florida with the female physician who's the head of family planning for the UN, and she's Pakistani, and I'm forgetting, unfortunately, her name right now, but she's had many dialogues with the president and with the Pope, for example, and trying to get the Pope to change his position in the church about this. Which, of course, she got nowhere, by the way. Zero response. And she's been doing this for 10 years when he actually did respond, you know, a decade ago. But she doesn't get anywhere. And she says, as a Pakistani female, you need to listen to me and, you know, really hear what happens. It's about, you know, it's about these horrible abuses of girls and women. But I don't. That was the excuse. That's what I read in the paper. And apparently no one knew what was going to happen because nothing happened.
It was because some of the money had been used for abortions in China someplace.
I don't believe that.
It was just a string that he was trying to hang his coat on.
Yeah, and if that was done corruptly or illegally with the forced abortions they have there of girls, or, you know, the 2 children and girls. But it's not, it's against the law to do that. So that must have been some corrupt something that happened.
Have you had any contact with the Beijing Women's Conference? I know it's beginning of this October.
We've gone, Genesis House has gone there in the past. I personally did not go. We had another representative there, but not specifically.
How big is this issue on their agenda, do you know?
On that, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I haven't gotten the literature yet on it, on what's going on. Although it could be there, because I haven't been in the country, actually.
I'm curious to know, where is the church at Genesis House?
Pardon me?
Where is the church, I mean the church body at Genesis?
We're non-denominational organization. We're not a ministry. We're a 501c3 not-for-profit. And so there's a strong spirituality component, but it is whatever God, church, whatever you choose to worship, a strong 12-step component with the higher power. But we are connected with a variety of churches that support us. The Catholic Church has a big problem with our condoms. It's funny, we keep them out in bowls, and people always think it's candy, and it's really funny to watch them go, oh. Take one! Take a condom! Pass it around, you know? Catholic Church has a little problem with that, but the radical Catholic Church doesn't, like the Call to Action group doesn't, but we're supported by all the Lutheran Church, we're supported by Presbyterian, Catholic people that are studying, Jesuits or whatever come. We have positive male role modeling with Jesuit students. Different people come, the men, to work with the women on spirituality and teach them about different kinds of men that exist in the world. And, you know, they're not all out to exploit you and hurt you. So it's an important part of our spirituality. And different churches take us on and do projects with us. And whoever wants to help us, whatever church wants to be involved, we're more than welcome. That there's a lot of church-related activity, but we are not a church. And the women themselves go to church on Sundays, and the church of their choice.
But if somebody was a Muslim or something, that would be fine too. I mean, it's a very open...
Yeah, we're non-denominational, but there's a big component of spirituality encouraging that. And there's always an ongoing volunteer. Women in ministry have been there in the past. When Ingrid used to bring groups from her school. So it's a big component, and it's strongly encouraged, but nobody's forced, you know, to do that.
I felt with, from being around these women, the strongest sense of spirituality I've ever felt around any group of people. So I just wanted to say thank you for all that.
Thank you. You are welcome.
Any other questions? Okay, tomorrow we'll talk about prostitution in the United States, social, economic, political factors, the way that the criminal justice system, and then, as I said, Friday will be Genesis House. And